Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Jonathan C. Slatt. He is the Russia and Northeast Asia Coordinator for the Wildlife Conservation Society. We're talking about his book, Owls of the Eastern Ice, A Quest to Find and Save the World's Largest Owl. Jonathan, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks, Mark. I'm excited to be here.
Let's start out describing Blakiston's fish owl, because I'm a hardcore birder and I know owls well. This owl looks crazy to begin with. I know it's big, but it looks like it's disheveled.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. I mean, these are bizarre looking birds. I mean, they're, you know, they stand almost the size of a fire hydrant and weigh, you know, the equivalent of almost a dozen crows. So they're just these big things. And they walk more than most owl species do. So, you know, you often see them kind of lumbering along a frozen riverbank. And it's just this bizarre mass of, yeah, disheveled feathers.
Now, this takes place in I have no Russian facility whatsoever. So Is it the Pomorai province?
Yep, Primorye.
Primorye, a province of extreme eastern Russia. It's on the Sea of Japan. Fill in some details of what this habitat is like, not just in winter, but generally.
Yeah, it's a pretty remarkable part of the world. It's a temperate region, but you have these intermingling tendrils of the boreal system coming south and the subtropical system moving north.
Wow.
So it's the only part of the world where you have subtropical species like tigers and leopards living in the same forest as, you know, the boreal species like brown bears and wolves and lynx. So it's a pretty remarkable place. I mean, if you think about, I assume that the forests in Massachusetts are similar, you know, oak and maple. So you have these, yep, you know, temperate forests, but with your tigers and brown bears walking through them. So it's a really remarkable place.
Now, how did you come to study this fish owl? Because you have been there before.
Right, yeah. So my dad was a U.S. diplomat stationed in Moscow in the early 1990s. And almost by chance, I accompanied him on a business trip, flying, you know, 9 hours east of Moscow to Vladivostok. And just really fell in love with it the first moment I saw it. It was just so wild looking. And I ended up I was there in the Peace Corps for 3 years. I spent a semester there as an undergraduate in college. And I did a master's degree there studying forest birds, which I found were impossible to find funding for, to be honest. And so when I was looking back for a PhD, I wanted to do something that was relevant to conservation of birds in that region. But I also didn't want to be really scraping together, you know, nickels and dimes to fund the work. So I wanted something that was a little more charismatic, and the fish owls are definitely one of the more charismatic and least studied birds of the region.
Had you even seen a fish owl up until that point?
You know, I had seen one once in the year 2000 in the Peace Corps. I saw one for probably 10 or 15 seconds, and I would not have even known what it was had I not taken photographs of it, which was pre-digital days, so it took me a few weeks to get the film developed. But once I had, you know, kind of this an unmoving bird in front of me on a photograph, I was able to identify it.
Now, what you're looking for to do here is not just sort of seeing the birds. You're trying to develop a conservation strategy. And talk to me what that means.
Sure. So there were essentially no conflicts between these birds and human interests for, you know, centuries, for, you know, most of the lives of these birds as a species. But you know, after the fall of the Soviet Union, suddenly there's an explosion of interest in the forests and the rivers where these birds and hunt. And so legally, under Russian law, an endangered species such as the fish owl, you cannot harm them or their habitat. But so little was known about them that there wasn't a species plan, a species protection plan, so there was nothing to refer to. So they were essentially being ignored as natural resource extraction was moving further and further into their habitat. So the point of the PhD project, which was a collaboration with some Russian scientists, was to really understand what the birds need, what's important about the forests and the rivers for these birds, which we could then convey to resource extraction industries to guide how they're using the forests. You go minimize damage to the birds.
You go through several stages. The first one is to figure out where the birds are. Are there birds there? Now, they call, and they duet, by the way. Explain to people how duetting is different from most birds singing.
Well, right. I mean, most birds, you know, honestly, it's just males who are doing most of the vocalizations to define territorial occupancy. And there, you know, some birds do duet. I believe it's 4% of bird species total that duet. And these owls do it. And it's a very synchronized four-note call where it's kind of a call and response. And it's just it's marvelous to hear.
Now, they do this at what time of the year?
They duet year-round, but most actively in the breeding season, which would be February or so.
Okay, so people have to realize what you're stepping into. You're going into a sparsely populated area of eastern Russia in winter, which seems a bit extreme, Jonathan. And as the way you describe it in the book, it's pretty incredible. Just even the temperatures go down to, 30 degrees centigrade?
Right, the mid-30s. Yeah, and zero infrastructure. I mean, what you have with you is all that you have to get yourself out of trouble if you run into trouble. And trouble is essentially omnipresent.
Oh, God. Well, the way you describe it, it's amazing. First of all, this is a book that's just as amazing as a sort of a travelogue of a very sparsely inhabited area, too, because the people are amazing that you talk to.
Yeah.
And I ended up both finding them fascinating and also just sort of wild. Winter means that they're not going to be out on the sea, on the ashore. They're going to be up along these rivers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no roads. So how are you accessing these?
Right. So, the first part of the book, we had to fly in by helicopter because it was an entirely roadless area. And the only travel in that region, there are two villages up there, mostly indigenous Udege. And the only means of travel are along the river. So in summer, that means by boat. And in winter, that means by snowmobile. And so that means that there are essentially two seasons where there's no travel at all because you can't, either there's melting ice or it's just otherwise dangerous to be on the water.
Do you even talk about it? At the time that you were there, when things are just maybe starting to break up, even traveling by snowmobile is dangerous because you have to cross these rivers. And there's this weird thing called, is it Nalid?
Right, yeah.
And you had a close call several times.
Yeah, we had multiple close calls. And as it turned out,
you sort of take this in stride. Is that just because
it's part of the, I think, the Russian experience. So, like, I'd already been there for 3 years in the Peace Corps. And you kind of, there's a lot of situations where you kind of just have to grit your teeth and ride it out. And you trust in the Russians you're with who have experienced more or less things like this before. But right, with the knowledge, it turned out that because we were new to the area, we were the last people to travel this 80-kilometer stretch of river between the two villages.
Wow.
All the locals had already stopped because they already figured it was too dangerous to go. So they were actually calling back and forth by phone as we were going along, wondering if we'd shown up yet or if we were going to make it or not. Because, the ice would just disappear behind our snowmobiles as we go, and then that's it.
Well, there's this weird condition called Nalid.
Yeah.
And talk about that.
Yeah, so Nalid, it's essentially in late winter, early spring, somewhere upriver, there might be some blockage in the water under the ice, and the water will push up through a hole and then flow atop the ice, creating these bands of essentially slush. And sometimes it's just, a couple inches deep. Sometimes it can be up to your waist. And also when you're approaching one of these things, it just looks like slushy water, and you don't know if there's going to be solid ice under there, or if you step in it, you're going to go right down to the bottom of the river. And we had, I don't know how many of these things across, but it was a lot.
And you were up to over your knees, and you had waders on.
Yeah,
in this frozen slushy stuff, praying to God that the next step or the next way, and you're taking these snowmobiles across, whether it's going to work or not.
Yeah, and in a few spots, we ended up having to actually get out chainsaws and cut a trail through the forest to kind of bypass some of these blockages. So it's definitely a gnarly trip.
Now, talk to me about that first time that you hear these duetting owls. It must have been incredibly special.
Oh yeah, I mean it's a very, very low noise, and I think that partially that's because these are birds that breed at very low densities, and the low frequencies are the frequencies that travel further through across a landscape or through a dense forest, and so it's a very, very low frequency. It's almost like a pulsing in your ears. And if there's anything else going on, there's a dog barking or, waves lapping up against the Sea of Japan shore or a river or a truck or something, you just miss it.
Wow. Now, you sort of plot out, you spend some seasons just sort of plotting out where the pairs of owls are. Now, these owls need very specific trees to nest in.
They do, yeah. So we said the first year essentially was just trying to figure out where these birds were, where we were going to work, and they require these massive, 200 to 300 year old growth riparian trees. So these water loving things like cottonwoods or poplars or elms that live near water and grow just to these huge sizes. And once they get that big, because these birds are so big, they can't just nest in any they're tree cavity nesters. They can't nest in any tree cavity. It has to be a really, really, really big tree cavity. And so once these trees get old enough, a branch will fall off because they're starting to decay, or the whole top will get knocked off in a storm, and the resulting depression that decays downward is what the owls will nest in.
Wow. Can you eventually learn to sort of recognize a probable nesting tree at a distance from the people that you're working with from Russia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because it sounds like the trees really sort of stood out from the other trees that were around them.
Yeah, no question. I mean, we're working in a floodplain, and so most of it is a lot of the forest is pretty messy. The understory is messy. There's a lot of vines, a lot of low shrubbery, and then suddenly you look ahead and bam, there's this like massive, smokestack of a thing in the distance. And so they're pretty rare on the landscape. So anytime we'd see a big tree, we'd walk over and try to get a sense of and look up for a cavity or something. I mean, and in some territories, we'd walk in, you spend a few days searching the forest, and we'd find one tree that was big enough, and that was the tree where there was a nest in.
Wow. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Jonathan C. Slatt. He is the Russia and Northeast Asia coordinator for the Wildlife Conservation Society. We're talking about his latest book. It's great. Owls of the Eastern Ice, A Quest to Find and Save the World's Largest Owl. I just realized I never talked about the fact that they are indeed fishing owls. What kind of fish are they taking?
Yeah, so there are four species of fish owls in Asia. There are also fishing owls that live in Africa.
Right.
They're different birds entirely. The ones in Russia and in Japan, the Blakiston's fish owl, they're taking mostly salmon. So there's a number of different salmon species, Pacific salmon species, that run up those rivers, and that's mostly what they're taking. In winter, they're pretty small, maybe 6 inches long or so. But then during the migration, they are taking fully sized salmon that are running up those rivers to spawn.
Are they taking them like an osprey? I mean, are they flying and snagging them, or are they actually like walking up to the edge of the water and then jumping in?
Yeah, from my experiences I've only observed them in winter hunting, and they're hunting in very shallow water, again, just a few inches deep, and they are just sitting on the bank and waiting in ambush for to swim by and then just jumping in. But they're landing in very, very shallow water. There does seem to be evidence elsewhere and at other times of year where they are diving osprey-like into deeper water after fish.
Now, I want to talk something about your companions and where you stayed. You basically had to hook up with people who would sort of lend you a cabin or tell you where an old cabin was. But the people that you sort of bumped into were just amazing and each had their own story. One of the most important things, and you're gonna, I need to know about this, is to know how to banya.
Yeah. I have to say, people who live in this part of the world, or this part of Russia, either by choice or by fate. I mean, if you can live there, you're pretty tough, creative. Person who is able to really make a lot of things work out of very little. The hunters I'm running into, the fishermen, just the villagers. I mean, these are folks that can fix, you know, any truck. They can catch anything they need to in the oceans or in the forests. So very, very creative, very hardy individuals. And so, you know, Banya is just, you know, it's just a sauna. But the Russians have really cultivated, you know, a procedure to Banya the correct way. And everyone, it's just like building a fire, right, where everyone has their own way. And, you know, you can often be accused of doing it wrong if you're not doing it the way that the host likes.
So you're really being judged for how you Banya.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's.
If you want to earn the respect of the locals, you want to know how to Banya well.
Yeah, it's how you essentially, how you drink and how you Banya are two really critical ways to get somebody to like you or not.
Well, I have to say, this is the only natural history book I think I've read in my lifetime that had so much drinking. Drinking takes place
in Russia.
I know. It's like people don't know that. It's a whole thing. People come over with a bottle of vodka, and that bottle is supposed to be done by that night.
Yeah, and just like the Banya, there are so many social customs around drinking. And since we were in so many new places on a regular basis, these customs are always being renewed. It wasn't, you go to a new place for the first time, you have to drink a lot. You go to another place for a new time, you have to drink a lot. If you return to those places later, those same things don't necessarily apply. It's not quite as intense.
Now, then people had weird, you would run into people with strange beliefs like pyramid stuff.
Right.
There was a whole thing where you ran into a whole collection of red deer penises.
Yeah, this was a guy who was the caretaker, middle of nowhere, like literally, like it's one of the most remote places I've ever been in my life. And so this was a guy who was a caretaker at a cabin that was owned by a sausage magnate, and who would fly in with his own helicopter and use this as like a hunting base. And the caretaker I don't know what he's basing this on, but believed that if you soaked dried deer penises in alcohol and then drank it, it would give you virility.
Of course.
And he did. Yeah, so he had a shed full of these things.
Now, there's a lot of other wildlife that is around that area, too. And one of the things I was most interested in is the Amur tiger. Is that what used to be called the Siberian tiger?
Yep, and it's interchangeable. It's just there are no tigers in Siberia. I mean, Siberia is the center of the country.
Yeah.
And the Amur River Basin in the Far East is where tigers do live, which is why Amur is the preferred term.
They're protected, correct?
Of course, yes.
But the locals didn't have a great feeling about the tigers at all.
Yeah, and I think that's common in the United States. That's common too, where like these large charismatic predators are in large cities like New York or Boston or Vladivostok or Moscow, things like tigers and wolves are cherished. Like people love the idea of a big thing running around the woods. But you go to a small town in Wyoming or you go to a small town in Primorya, and there's a fear, there's a mistrust of these large predators because they feel like there's a direct conflict between their livelihood and the livelihood of these animals. So a tiger might be eating the same deer that a hunter wants to shoot to then feed his family with.
Now, the second part of your research was to actually trap owls and initially put transmitters on them that you could follow. Mm-hmm. And so how did you develop a trap? You went through several different kinds and you had to find a good way to put out bait too. What did you eventually arrive at?
Yeah, so I mean, we went into the trapping part knowing it was going to be tough. I mean, I'd spoken to some raptor capture specialists in the U.S., and the traps to capture birds like this, you know, these are very suspicious birds overall. And so traps are often very species-specific. Like one thing that'll work with a sharp-shinned hawk, for example, won't necessarily work with a bald eagle. So we had a couple ideas of what might work for a fishing raptor. And you brought over a bunch of raw materials and different trap components and just tried different things. And it took a really long time, most of a field season, to find something that worked. And what we ended up doing was putting a small box into the shallow water where the owls are hunting, catching fish nearby, and then putting fish into that box. So essentially, you know, just lures, putting lures into a space that was safe to actually catch an owl, and then built our trap around that.
And it worked.
It worked very well, yeah.
Now, once you initially put on sort of a vest on the owl that would have these transmitters on them, and then you would go around, and how great a distance were they effective?
Well, so they're little backpacks. They're just these thin little straps kind of underneath the wing, and the unit, which is about the size of like a AA battery, would sit on the back of the bird with the long antenna. And that should, which kind of contours against the body. And in theory, those should last for several years and carry over a distance of, up to 5-7 kilometers, depending on where the bird was and where we were trying to use our antenna to find it.
But
they pulled the antennas off almost immediately.
They also pulled the vest. Didn't they pull the whole vest off?
One pulled the vest off, but most were just ripping off the antennas.
Oh my god!
So like all the effort, it's just.
I can't imagine the frustration.
Yeah. So it was a huge problem because the whole point of the whole thing was to be able to catch the birds and then track them over a period of years. And if they're pulling off their antennas after a few months, it's not doing us any good, and it's certainly not doing the birds any good.
So eventually you arrived at using these GPS recorders where they would record where they were, but that just led to another problem. You had to retrap those same owls to take the recorder off.
Exactly. So what we found was a unit that did not have an external antenna, so something that the birds could not just rip off. But the downside of no antenna means that it can't transmit. So it was just this little patch receiver that would receive GPS locations and would take 1 to 2 a day for about a year. That's how long the battery would last.
Wow.
But then, we'd have to recapture that same bird at some point in the future to download the data.
Now, when you get that data, how does it translate into a map of where they went?
They're just GPS points. It's just like when you on your phone or your handheld GPS unit, it just gives you the track of where the birds went and at what time.
It seems like it would be a tremendous, it's not just an automatic thing. It would take you weeks in order to translate the data from the actual device to a computer thing that you could use.
Actually, no, it's minutes. I mean,
really?
The data are in a standard GPS format.
And you can just plug in a map and then
essentially, yes. It's just a simple conversion to some format.
Wow.
That the map program reads, and then it was instant gratification. I mean,
fantastic.
When we recapture one of these birds, and we'd run into the hut or into the truck, plug it in, and just see where the bird went. It was wonderful.
Well, let me ask you about capturing these owls, because I had an unfortunate run-in with a barred owl that had been hit by a car but was still very much alive, and so without thinking, I went and grabbed it, and it sunk its talons into my arm like bone deep. And I had to stick it in a bag upside down, and it eventually let loose. And then I was able to bring it to the animal treatment center.
Yeah.
I can't imagine handling these huge owls.
Yeah. Well, and also, behaviorally, raptors are different. And, barn owl or barred owls are from the Strix genus, and those are notoriously more aggressive than these. And so we didn't know, honestly. No one had really caught adult fish owls. No one knew how they were going to react.
Oh, my God.
And I was just absolutely pleased to learn that they're docile in the hand.
No. I am skeptical.
Because they're so big, I think, and they don't really have natural predators. I think they're not used to being messed with. Whereas a barred owl, they have great horned owls to deal with. So these things, you grab them, and they just kind of just like, they kind of tense up and stiffen. And as long as you're applying a little bit of pressure to their wings and you're holding their talons, they mostly get that they're stuck.
How long would it take? You would actually take them back sometimes to the cabin or wherever you were to affix the transmitter. And one you actually had to keep overnight.
Yes, it would take about an hour from capture to release. Taking measurements, drawing blood, putting on the transmitters, usually about an hour. But in some cases, it would be longer. And the one we had to keep overnight, the way we set up our traps, we find a space that's wide riverbank where the bird, once it's caught in a snare, will typically fly onto the ice or onto the snow of the bank.
Yeah.
And in this one case, she flew into the water. And the water wasn't deep, but it was, minus 30 something.
Yeah.
And she was soaked, and we were not going to release a soaking wet bird who's stressed out from a capture,
yep, absolutely,
back into the forest at minus 30. So we just kept her in a box overnight, let her dry off, and let her go in the morning.
Did you lose any birds in the interim between initially tagging them and then later?
Not during the course of the study. We recaptured every bird that we put a transmitter on. Subsequently, you know, years later, we did lose some birds. And the one that we kept in a box, for example, several years later, she was found dead next to the road. She'd been hit by a car and killed.
Now, the great thing about this story is that the research paid off, in that you were able to find out what kind of habitat they needed to breed in, what kind of habitat that they needed to nest in, and that could be turned into a conservation plan to work with the logging interests.
Right, and I think it was a pretty unique situation where, you know, it's not like the conflict between loggers and owls in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, with the spotted owl.
Right. So here, for the most part, the trees that the owls are nesting in, the trees that are important for the owls, are commercially worthless. It's not a, you know, $100,000 sequoia. It's a, you know, it's this worthless thing, and mostly they're being cut down by the loggers because they're in the way of where they're planning to put a road, or sometimes they cut them down to use them to build bridges. So if, you know, one of the outcomes of the research was a map showing, you know, 60 locations that were really important for fish owls,
wow,
either, you know, old growth patch of forest or a place where they were hunting. And so the logging company now knows if they're going up this river valley to put in a new road, they know to put the road more to the right or more to the left to avoid one of these patches. And so it's not, you know, it helps them because they're now complying with the law, and it's not, you know, they're not losing any money by shifting the road one way or the other.
It's an amazing piece of work. And again, this book is really a wonderful read because it's part conservation and ornithology, but part just travelogue to that. We personally know so little about that area, and it was fantastic to read about it. My guest tonight has been Jonathan C. Slatt. He is the Russia and Northeast Asia coordinator for the Wildlife Conservation Society, and we've been talking about his book. It's an amazing read. Owls of the Eastern Ice, A Quest to Find and Save the World's Largest Owl. Jonathan, it's been great.
Thanks, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.